Go ahead, ma'am.
Thanks, operator, and hi, everybody. Thanks for joining today. We're here to talk about an issue that is much in the press of late, and we want to give you some insight into some key potential outcomes with the potential RVO decision. So we have some great speakers today, and with me I have Jeff Cooper, who's Vice President for Research at the Renewable Fuels Association. I have Chris Stanley, who's EVP at Abengoa Bioenergy, and Jan Konix, who's Global Business Director for biorefineries with DuPont. So at this time, I will go ahead and hand the call over to Jeff Cooper. Jeff, go ahead.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Ann, and thanks to all of you for joining us this morning. We know that you're all busy people, so we appreciate your time here over the next half hour or so. Certainly, as you all know by now, a draft of EPA's proposed rule for the 2014 RFS requirements was leaked several weeks ago, and it's obviously caused quite a stir. According to press reports, EPA is considering or has considered cutting next year's RFS requirements by about 16%, reducing the volume from 18.15 billion gallons to just 15.21 billion gallons. And those would be across the board cuts. So in addition to cutting the advanced biofuel requirements, the leaked draft is suggesting that EPA would also consider cutting the requirement for conventional renewable fuel, and that's the portion of the RFS for which corn ethanol qualifies. EPA is apparently considering these cuts because of the so-called E10 blend wall and the false notion that the infrastructure and vehicles needed to meet the 2014 statutory requirements don't exist. However, the law does not allow EPA to exercise its general waiver authority based on the presumption or the idea that infrastructure constraints will limit renewable fuel consumption. Rather, that waiver authority that's in the statute it's limited to cases where there is inadequate domestic supply of renewable fuels to meet the requirement. And I will tell you that inadequate domestic supply is not going to be a problem for us next year. The law calls for 14.4 billion gallons next year, and the existing corn ethanol industry has the nameplate capacity to produce about 14.8 billion gallons and the physical capacity to produce well over 15 billion. And our industry has already shown that it can operate at those levels. In late 2011, the industry was running at an annualized rate of about 14.7 billion gallons. And here just in the last few weeks, we've been running at about 14 billion gallons. So domestic supply to meet that 14.4 billion gallon requirement that appears in the law would not be a problem next year. However, EPA reportedly has considered lowering the 14.4 billion gallon volume by 1.4 to 2 billion gallons because of the purported blend wall issues. Now, I want to make clear that the official proposed rule has not yet been published. We do expect that to happen soon. So what is in the draft or what has been reported to be in the draft could change. But to drive home the importance of this decision and the importance of these 2014 RVOs, we did some very simple analysis to see what such a cut would really mean for our industry, the ethanol industry, the oil industry, and for the American consumer. And I want to make clear that we examined just the impacts of a cut to the corn ethanol number, to that 14.4, and I'm going to let Chris and Jan address what this would mean to the advanced sector. The bottom line is, cutting the RFS would be a huge victory for big oil and a devastating loss for American consumers, and I'm just not sure that EPA wants that on its head. In essence, it really is kind of common sense. Reducing the amount of renewable fuel that would be required would decrease refiner and blender purchases of ethanol, it would increase the sales volume of gasoline, and would also increase the price of gasoline. Not only that, it would discourage or eliminate the need for oil companies and their downstream partners to invest in modern refueling infrastructure. So when you kind of total up all of those impacts based on the 1.4 to 2 billion gallon cut that is being discussed in the leaked draft, we're talking about a gross financial impact of about $9 to $15 billion. For the oil industry. And I want to break down where that number comes from. Obviously, if you cut the renewable fuel requirement by 1.2 to 2 billion gallons of ethanol, you're reducing the amount of ethanol that needs to be purchased by oil refiners and blenders, and that would save them, roughly $2 to $3.5 billion based on 2014 futures prices. And so in turn, they'd be replacing that lost ethanol volume with their own product, with gasoline. And so on an energy equivalent basis, they'd be raking in an extra $2.5 to $4 billion in revenue from selling the gasoline that replaced the lost ethanol volume. So in other words, instead of spending $2 to $3 billion on ethanol, they'd be making an additional $2 to $4 billion on gasoline. So a swing of $4 to $7 billion right there. But it goes well beyond that. Replacing the amount of ethanol that would be lost with gasoline would increase demand for gasoline in the aggregate, and that would increase prices for every gallon of gasoline sold in the U.S. next year. Some economists at Louisiana State recently looked at this supply-demand elasticity of gasoline and ethanol, and they concluded that every billion gallons of increase in gasoline demand increases gas prices by as much as 6 cents a gallon. So based on these volumes we're talking about, that could increase the price of gasoline for American consumers by a total of about $7 to $11 billion next year in 2014. So again, beyond all of this, if EPA were to lower the RVOs for 2014, it would send a very clear signal to the oil industry and their partners, their marketers and retail partners, that they, we don't need to invest in E85 infrastructure or E15 infrastructure. We continue to believe that there's enough infrastructure in place today to distribute that 14.4 billion gallons in 2014. But what would very likely happen if EPA held the line on that number is we'd see investments in infrastructure that's going to be needed to meet the RFS targets beyond 2014. So once you get into 2015, 2016, we're going to need some more E85 stations in order to meet the volumetric requirements that are in the law. So by our simple calculations, the oil companies could keep an extra $200 to $400 million in their pockets because they would not need to invest that money in infrastructure if EPA were to move forward with some kind of cuts to the RVOs. So again, this is not pocket change we're talking about, and the oil industry likes to talk about the blend wall being a consumer safety issue and a misfueling issue. But when it all, when you peel back the onion, this all boils down to money. A decision to lower the RVO in 2014 would be a huge step backward for the corn ethanol industry, and it would amount to a substantial transfer of wealth away from America's farmers and small businesses to oil and gas companies and foreign oil producers. So that's a quick look at how our industry is viewing the potential consequences or outcomes of this pending EPA decision. And at this time, I want to hand off to Chris Stanley from Abengoa, who's going to comment on what all of this uncertainty means for his company and specifically to the advanced and cellulosic sector.
Thanks, Chris? Jeff. Thanks again. We certainly echo your comments, and I'd like to talk briefly about Abengoa's perspective as a producer of both conventional ethanol and second-generation advanced biofuels. Certainly, it's our belief that if the leaked draft of the RVO is actually published and finalized, although, as Jeff said, as of today, no one in the EPA or anywhere will confirm that is the intent or that is the final draft, but if it is, it would dramatically impact both conventional biofuels and also advanced biofuels. For the first time in the history of the RFS, which, of course, was originally designed to help break the monopolistic hold that petroleum companies have on the domestic transportation fuel market, and that's due, of course, to their control of both the production as well as the downstream distribution of all fuels. But if that were to happen, the EPA will be reducing the requirement for renewable fuels not only below both statutory requirements and available supply levels, but also well below the levels actually consumed in 2013. And we believe that this will effectively kill any future investment in advanced biofuels. Why is that? First of all, first-generation renewable fuel producers are, among others, now making huge investments and will be the logical first adopters of second-generation fuels. Existing plants, infrastructure, relationship with farmers, and those sorts of things make the investors that grew the first-generation ethanol industry from 2% to 10% of our transportation fuel supply in just a few short years will make those same investors the likely investors in second generation, the likely initial investors in second generation advanced biofuels. Secondly, this clear message of policy reversal in just the fifth year of a 15-year fuel policy by the administration would send a chill into the investment community with regard to advanced biofuel investments. While existing projects already financed and under construction will likely continue, any future investment will have no assurance of a market and would likely evaporate. The impact of this leaked draft was immediate, as publicly traded biofuel producers saw their stock prices drop, and analysts reviewed their outlook for the refinery sector and raised it, and for the renewable fuel sector and lowered it. Investors have already started to back away from any further investments in advanced renewable fuels, and companies that make those fuels are already thinking about moving those investments overseas to a more receptive market, costing the U.S. significant potential jobs and major investments. Avangoa has renewable fuel production investments on three continents today. We've invested well over $1 billion in addition to our existing facilities. We've invested over $1 billion developing cellulosic ethanol over the last 10 years. We've done this at laboratory scale, pilot plant scale, and demonstration scale facilities. And now we expect to complete construction by January of this next year on one of the world's first commercial scale cellulosic ethanol facilities. This is a facility that can make fuel from agricultural residues such as corn stover, wheat straw, and stover of other plants, and from other waste products such as prairie grasses and wood waste. This facility we're building is a tremendous economic asset to the region. We're currently employing over 1,000 full-time construction workers for the last 6 months of our construction effort, and we've averaged well over 300 full-time construction jobs over the 27-month construction period that the project has been going on. When it's completed within the next few months, this facility will make 25 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol at a price that is competitive with gasoline. It will also make 21 megawatts of electric power and enough steam to make the facility completely energy independent. We will employ 75 full-time local employees and pay a $5 million annual payroll, and we will pay local farmers within a 50-mile radius of the plant about $17 million each year to take less than 15% of their excess crop residues as our only feedstock to produce fuel. Our intention has been to develop this process and roll it out at several of our other existing first-generation facilities, as well as licensing the technology to other producers and non-producers, so that other corn ethanol producers could do the same. Publication of this leaked draft would force us to reexamine that investment plan and to consider other countries that are more friendly for future investment. It would impact existing facility margins and likely result in plant shutdowns and employee layoffs, making it much more difficult to continue to invest in this advanced industry that otherwise has shown such a great promise. The approach in this alleged EPA draft is inconsistent with the RFS statute. It is inconsistent with EPA's previous interpretations of the statute, and it's inconsistent with the president's often repeated statements of policies to encourage development of alternatives to oil and transportation fuels. It will protect the oil sector's monopoly over the fuel system and give them the absolute right to limit the amount of renewable fuel blended into our nation's fuel supply to less than 10%. This would assure a continuation of oil's record profits and would cost consumers more at the pump, as well as undermining the entire purpose of the RFS. With that, those are Avangoa's comments. I would like to hand it over at this point to Jan Koenig with DuPont.
Thank you, Chris, and I want to thank everybody on the call for joining us here. I joined the call as well as Jeff and Chris to express concerns over this leaked EPA RVO targets, which are very surprising and truly very disappointing. I'll keep my comments brief. I second most of what, or all of what, better said, all of what Jeff and Chris have said. and they've described the situation very well. As DuPont, as a science company, we have tremendous experience in commercializing new technologies in a host of products that you guys are familiar with, the Teflons, the Kevlar, these kind of things. And also in ag biotech and industrial biotech, we've brought a lot of projects to commercialization. We know how to do this, and we know that this one also will be a very good technology, this advanced cellulosic ethanol technology. Be a very good technology and a very commercially viable technology. The RFS is key in making this possible because this large fuel market, which is so critical to the world and to the country, is controlled by the incumbent industry, the oil industry. And just like any typical incumbent industry, they struggle with bringing innovation. They like the status quo. They have all done, more or less, depending upon on which of the participants, which of the oil companies, they've participated in some of the innovation. They may have done some of the research in renewable energy. But in the end, most of them have stuck with the mature technologies, with the technologies that have brought us now, as I just heard this morning on the radio, last year record greenhouse gas emissions. So this technology needs a route to market in order to benefit the country and to benefit the world and to benefit all of us. And this technology will find its way to market. I'm quite convinced that we will be successful. We have a great resolve, just like Chris at Abengoa. We will get this technology to commercialization. The tactic of the incumbent oil companies to create doubt around this may slow us down, or it may take the leadership away in this development from the U.S. But eventually, this technology will be commercialized. Still, it's a great opportunity for which we don't have to wait. And if we implement the RFS as it is conceived and as it is put in place, then we will see, in short term, great benefit, as we already see from corn ethanol. We'll add to that with advanced biofuels from biomass. Our Nevada facility, Nevada, Iowa, Central Iowa facility, which we are constructing, is similar to Abengoa's facility, a large cellulosic ethanol plant, 30 million gallons. And the numbers around the construction project are similar. Many jobs there, 75 permanent jobs. Eventually, purchase of corn stover in the immediate area, about 30 to 40 miles around the plant. And incidentally, a great contributor to the further renewal and improvement of corn harvest techniques. So a great joining hands of agriculture and energy there. The first gen and second gen are very much connected, as Jeff and Chris already explained. There's synergies between the two forms of technology. There is know-how and there's experience to be shared. And furthermore, there's a great base to build on. So we're very concerned about the RVO numbers that have been leaked, which, as Chris said very well, we're not sure whether or not they're fact or not at this point. It can be confirmed. But if it is, it's a reversal. It's something that very much surprises and disappoints us, and it's something that will rob the country of a great opportunity. Anne, back to you.
Great. Thanks all for those great remarks. Operator, at this point, we are ready to take questions.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question today, it is star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that's star 1 at this time if you'd like to ask a question. We'll take our first question from Rachel Gantz with Oil Price Information Services.
For hosting this call, this is actually a related question. Do you expect the cellulosic ethanol tax credit to be extended? And if not, what effect would that have on the industry in conjunction with a possible lower RVOs for the cellulosic biofuel pool?
Yeah, I can take that. Anne?
Yeah, go ahead, Jan.
Well, I think we don't know. So at this point, what happens in Washington is fairly unpredictable, I think we can say. It certainly is something that would help, and it is something that would further reduce, mitigate the risk to the investor. It's something that we would always expect to be temporary. what it will be extended or not, we simply don't know. Chris, you want to add?
No, I think that's exactly it. We, you know, certainly the cellulosic ethanol tax credit would promote further investment by reducing risk, but, you know, certainly the number one market driver, in our opinion, for the development of this new fuel is the renewable fuel standard.
Thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Amanda Paterka with Greenwire.
Hey, thanks for taking my question. Jeff, I think this is for you. In your analysis, you mentioned that this would be amount to a substantial transfer of wealth away from America's farmers to the oil and gas companies. I think I'm not sure if you already have this up on your blog, but I was wondering if you sort of quantified what this would mean for the rural communities, for the rural economy. You know, where can we expect to see the price of corn go if this proposal is put in place, and what does that do for farmers, et cetera?
Sure. Yeah, we have looked at that, and I think it's safe to say that the impact on the agricultural community would be severe. You know, there's a report from Deutsche Bank that came out a couple weeks ago that suggested that if EPA were to finalize what appeared in the leaked draft, and assuming that they would continue to make those kind of revisions to the RFS moving forward, you could see a 20 to 25% reduction in corn prices over the long term. And I think it's important to point out that farmers are right now in the midst of harvesting what will surely be a record crop, probably 14 billion bushels. Corn prices are at a three-year low. I think they closed at 4.25 per bushel yesterday. So this is not the time to be taking that stimulus away from the agricultural commodity markets. You know, fertilizer prices haven't come down. Diesel fuel prices haven't come down. So the cost of producing that crop hasn't fallen along with the value of the corn itself. So, you know, I can tell you that the corn sector is very concerned about what this might mean to the value of not just the corn crop, but to farm income as a whole next year and beyond.
And Amanda, this is Jan Collins. I'd like to add to it that at the same time, of course, it will raise the oil price, since it will increase the demand for oil product. And I don't have an estimate or a guess as to how much, but it's without a doubt it'll increase the demand and therefore the price.
Mm-hmm. And Chris Stanley, I'd like to add one other point, and that is that a reduction in corn prices in the long term could certainly increase the need for government farm subsidies, which have dramatically been reduced thanks to the benefits of the ethanol industry. So.
Yeah, particularly at a time when there's great uncertainty around the future of the farm bill and the future of the safety net for producers. This would just be a monumentally scary thing for rural America.
Do you see this affecting livestock producers? Do you see it doing anything to the price of livestock feed if they have less DDGs being produced?
We actually did conduct an analysis last year looking at what the impact on distillers grains prices would be if EPA had granted the waiver that was requested by a few governors last year. And absolutely, it stands to reason that if the RFS is reduced, you're grinding less corn for ethanol and therefore producing less distillers grains. A smaller supply of distillers grains means the price goes up. And so livestock producers would lose some of that benefit of that, you know, distillers grains has historically been priced well below corn and actually has a superior feed content, feed value. So they would be affected in that way. And that's not something that they typically think about, but absolutely would be the case. We're seeing very strong demand for distillers grains right now. You know, the price of corn has really plummeted, but the price of distillers grains has held up pretty well, and I think that just goes to show that there is extremely strong demand for this product, which is high in protein and high in energy, and we're certainly exporting a lot of it today. So, yeah, I mean, you reduce ethanol production, you reduce distillers' grains production, and that has some impact on the feed markets.
Great, thank you.
And we'll take our next question from Elliot Blackburn with Argus Media.
Hi, thanks for holding this call. I appreciate it. I had a quick, technical question about the study for Jeff and then a more general question for you guys. On the study, Jeff, what was the assumption that you guys made on gasoline demand to arrive at these numbers, just so I can understand that?
Sure. We used the EIA projection for next year. It's 131.9 billion gallons.
Okay, thank you. That's very helpful. And then I guess generally, you guys have made some inroads kind of locally, made some efforts to reach out directly to retail stations and to incent some, help fund or incent new blender dispensers. I'm just wondering what opportunity is there to continue to do that or maybe expand that, and what efforts has the industry made to kind of reach directly to the retailers and try to get around this, this infrastructure issue?
Sure. Well, I'll comment on that first, and then maybe Chris or Jan may have some thoughts as well. But we absolutely, the industry has, I would say, taken the bull by the horns over the last few years in terms of working directly with retailers to get more higher-level ethanol blends out there. Today, we have ethanol plants that are doing their own blending of E85 at the facility. They have registered to be blenders of record, and they're making their own E85 on site and selling directly to retail or wholesale and kind of cutting out that middleman to ensure the product is priced appropriately for consumers. We've seen the number of stations increasing, offering E85 increase by about 200 stations this year because of the economics. Ethanol is priced about a dollar under gasoline today, and those RIN values that were higher earlier in the year were also encouraging E85 consumption increases. So we are seeing some traction and movement there. We're also seeing some growth in the stations offering E15. And to your point, a lot of this is being catalyzed by our industry itself, going door to door to these gasoline stations, convincing them that this is of the value proposition, and once you're able to show them what's in it for them, there's a lot of these stations that are willing and excited to begin offering these higher level blends. So we expect to continue that, and we expect to see continued growth in both E85 and E15. At retail.
Jeff, this is Chris, and to kind of add on to that a little bit, I think the stations that have done that are offering, E15, E85, and other options, have found that our consumer research on the desires of consumer to purchase more renewable fuels, and I think the studies that have been done indicate that as much as 80% of consumers would choose more renewable fuels and would like to see more renewable fuels available. But it's my understanding that the stations that do offer both, in addition to the traditional E10 level, that stations offer E15 and E85 as other choices, they've found that as much as 25% of their sales volumes have been ethanol. Consumers have chosen to buy ethanol blends for various reasons, with largely price, with E15 being priced traditionally at least 5 to 15 cents per gallon below even E10, it makes it very attractive, and consumers are of course very interested in saving money at the pump.
And along with that, I would point out that a lot of retailers that have added E15 and E85 are picking up a new customer base, and are also seeing their in-store sales increasing. So they're selling more candy bars and soda pop and all that kind of stuff too. So there is a very strong business case, I think, to be made at the retail level for offering these fuels. You hear from API and AFPM that, well, the consumers just don't want higher-level ethanol blends, and that's just nonsense and doesn't square with what we're seeing on the ground.
Well, I mean, given that, what are the limiting factors? I mean, why are we not why isn't this taking off faster? What are kind of the hurdles that still have to be overcome to get more of these direct relationships?
Well, you know, I think it is it's primarily an infrastructure issue at this point, and that requires investment. You know, it costs money to switch a station over to E15 or E85, and it takes education to sell the retailer on the value proposition and to show them that they're going to get a fairly quick return on that investment. So it's just, you know, it's just kind of a, like I said, it's kind of a door-to-door process, going retailer to retailer, and we're having great success. But there are 130,000 gas stations out there, you know, so it takes time. But I also would point out that we are seeing very rapid growth in E85 sales. Unfortunately, there is no national tracking mechanism of E85 sales, but the states that track it for tax or revenue purposes are showing dramatic growth in E85 consumption. And to Chris's point, that's all being driven by the pricing. A large part of the discount for E85 has been driven by the RFS and the RIN mechanism. So, again, if you leave that mechanism in place and enforce it, it's going to drive the behavior that the policy was intended to drive.
Thank you.
And again, ladies
and
gentlemen,
I guess if I could, I'd put in a really quick plug right here for a couple of three papers on these very issues that were released just yesterday by Iowa State University, the Card Center there, looking at how RINs factor into all this, looking at how E85 can be used to break the blend wall. So I think it's very good stuff that if you have a few minutes, you all would probably benefit from looking at that.
There is also a white paper written by Butamax, our joint venture with BP on butanol. And that white paper explains also how the RINs mechanism actually works today. There's a lot of misinformation about RINs. And so you can find it on the Butamax website. And I think it gives you a good and quick quantified explanation. So with small examples, with numbers, so you can sort of follow what happens when the RIN goes up and down and how that enables E85 sales and is all cost neutral to the consumer.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, that's star one on your touchtone telephone. If you do have a question, we'll go next to Tiffany Stecker with ClimateWire.
Hi, thanks for holding the call. So I have two questions, if that's okay. I'm wondering if the... if EPA lowers the conventional ethanol RVO as suggested in the leaked draft, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but in case it does, will there be any kind of change in your message or your or in the kind of strategies you are employing? Second of all, several of you have mentioned the loss of investment due to the information in this draft and kind of concerns over RINs. Are there any examples you can tell me about of maybe plants or investors that have pulled out of the project or plants that have considered or are planning to move abroad?
Well, Tiffany, this is Jeff, and I can take the first one and leave mm-hmm. the second question for Chris and Jan. But I want to make sure I understand the nature of your question. You said if EPA were to lower the conventional renewable fuel volume, would yeah. we change our strategy or our approach
right.
relative to what?
I'm relative to what's been done in the last few years in at a time when EPA was continually raising the RVO and also ruling in making decisions in favor of the industry. For example, the denial of the petition last summer to amend the RVO.
Okay. Well, I guess I would answer that by saying you know we our industry and our association strongly support the RFS as it was written. and as it was intended to be enforced by Congress, and I don't see that position changing, relative to what EPA decides with this particular RVO.
I asked because there have been some other groups who have said that they, depending on what EPA comes out with, they may pursue other strategies or in the wider biofuels world. They said that, so I'm just wondering if that's a possibility with you, but you're saying that, no, you're going to stay strong on what.
Well, I mean, look, we're always pursuing any options to grow the market for renewable fuels. It just so happens that the RFS, in our mind, has been the most successful and best way of growing the market and creating a market for the second generation of biofuels. But gosh, yeah, we're going to be looking at continuing to grow the export market. We're going to be looking at continuing our work with the automakers on high octane type fuels that marry up well with the future engine technologies they're looking at. There's a whole range of things we're doing to try and grow demand for renewable fuels.
Now, this is Chris Stanley. I'll add on to that a little bit, again, from Abengoa's perspective. Certainly, if the EPA effectively lowers the ability to blend conventional ethanol, that change in message would change the way we at Abengoa consider our own investments. We built three brand-new large conventional ethanol plants since 2005 in reliance upon the RFS. Those are expensive plants. We've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in doing that here in the U.S., and that's just here in the U.S. By reducing the ability to blend conventional biofuels, even if there's still a focus on second generation or advanced biofuels, basically the EPA would be asking us to strand our existing investments in order to invest in new second generation assets that, may or may not be supported by this policy in the future. It just sends such an inconsistent message of policy support that it calls into question, any type of future policy. What that does for Abengoa, frankly, it requires us to reevaluate and change the way we consider our future investments. We're looking very heavily at Brazil. We have some assets in Brazil. Brazil, frankly, is very open and encouraging to new second-generation biofuels investments, and I think the United States could potentially lose a lot by taking a step like this. When, frankly, just a year ago at our Abengoa's worldwide biofuels conference that we hold in Seville in every May, actually this was just in last May, our CEO opened the conference by saying, talking to the European Parliament and saying, look, Europe, you could learn a lesson from the United States in how to develop a new fuel and incent the development of new economic. And the bottom line is, at this point, we really don't feel that way anymore. So it's going to be devastating on many levels.
So have there been any examples of companies that or investors that have already taken a step back publicly?
I'm not familiar with specific names. I can tell you that we've started to reevaluate our own strategy, and I believe that there are many others that have indicated to us privately that I wouldn't want to name specifically that they're doing the same thing.
Well, yeah, and Tiffany, this is Jeff. I would add to that this, the signals being sent here aren't just being received by biofuel producers or prospective biofuel producers and investors. We're aware of a fairly large retail gasoline chain here in the Midwest that was taking a very hard look at making some serious investments in E15. And they've told us, well, we kind of want to wait and see how this all plays out before deciding what we, you know, whether we want to move forward with that or not. And we're certainly not at liberty to discuss names, but that's the kind of thing that we're seeing happen as a result of just this leaked draft. This isn't even a formal proposal.
All right, thank you.
Let me add just a few words. As far as DuPont is concerned, we've worked on this since the early 2000s. Are we going to shift our strategy and change what we do on the basis of one EPA decision? No. We're in this in a very committed way for the long haul. And this is technology, as I said earlier, that's very viable and is going to see the light of day as we are commercializing it today. What we do see here is just a typical, market that's under the influence of a powerful incumbent industry that's resisting innovation. And in the long run, those barriers get knocked down. Now, this may take, as Chris alluded to, as Jeff alluded to, this may take the U.S. out of the leadership role in biofuels. If not just this one decision by EPA, but if the RFS is indeed not implemented. It is the RFS that brought leadership in biofuels. And in many ways, therefore, in a lot of associated industrial biotechnology research to the U.S., if you go back to 2005 or 2006, say, that time period, you'll find that everybody that knew anything about biofuels would tell you that Brazil was leading the world. That's certainly not the case anymore. But if we don't implement the RFS, which is visionary, feasible, realistic, and has a really positive impact, then the U.S. may lead that leadership again. And companies like Abengoa, a European company, companies like DSM, a Dutch company, that invest in these technologies here, are much less likely to come. So our strategy will not immediately change. We're very committed to this. We're going to commercialize this, and we're going to get this out in the world. How this further evolves in the U.S. is more up to the regulatory, legislative, and administrative decisions.
Great. Thanks a lot.
We'll go next to Edward Felker with Energy Guardian.
Yeah. Hi, guys. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can just so that we're clear, what is the ask that you feel the industry is presenting to the administration right now? Is it the entire statutory amount, less the cellulosic that doesn't meet the statutory, or are you all presenting some other option some other middle ground option that lets them say that they're addressing concerns raised about the blend wall while still making your industry whole?
We simply want stability of the regulatory environment. As we who have been working on biofuels technology, be it first generation or advanced, have been working on mitigating risks, technology risks, supply chain risks, capital risks, what we really don't want and don't need is an increased regulatory risk or uncertainty. It doesn't have to be there. What we need to see is leadership in simply implementing the law that's there. And we recognize that the law allows the EPA to make adjustments to levels and target volumes within a certain framework that's spelled out in the law and a certain logic, which, if the leaked documents and the leaked volumes are correct, we don't see it consistent with that. What we need is very simply leadership in implementing the law as it is.
Yeah, this is Jeff, and I would add to that, as Jan pointed out, the law does allow EPA to make certain adjustments to the cellulosic and advanced biofuel pieces of the RFS. If they reduce the cellulosic biofuel standard, they can reduce the advanced biofuel standard by the same amount and the overall RFS by the same amount. But there is nothing in the statute that would allow EPA to, in a willy-nilly fashion, reduce or adjust that residual part of the RFS, that conventional renewable fuel piece. The only way they can touch that is through their general waiver authority, and the conditions for exercising that authority are pretty clear in the statute. So I think, one of our key asks to the EPA is, go back and look at the statute. And, you know, we're reminding them of what their authorities really allow them to do. You know, and I guess the bottom line is, and Jan said generally the same thing, is, you know, the message that these type of cuts sends is that the RFS can be set based on the blend wall each and every year. And if that's the case, you know, we wouldn't expect the RFS to really catalyze any further growth in the industry. If that's the criteria for setting the RFS volumes, we've got a problem. So that's really the ask, or I guess the message that we're sharing with EPA today.
Ability here to reduce sugarcane ethanol from Brazil and in the advanced pool, and from the advanced pool, I mean, I've seen some analysis that if they worked on that, it might actually grow the market somewhat or give additional flexibility on the corn ethanol side.
I missed the first part of your question. I don't know if the phone was on mute or something, but do you mind repeating that?
Yeah, how's this?
That's better.
What I've read is that EPA could work on the advanced, as you talked about, the cellulosic and advanced pools that would actually clear some space for additional domestic corn ethanol. Is that your understanding, and how effective would that be?
Well, again, EPA has the ability through the annual RVO rulemaking process to reduce the cellulosic biofuel requirement based on what they believe will be reasonably available. Then they may reduce the advanced biofuel standard by the same amount, but they don't have to. And what we've seen in the last several years is they've reduced the cellulosic requirement but left the advanced biofuel standard whole, and that has effectively allowed other advanced biofuels to make up for that shortfall in cellulosic biofuel. Now, I believe what you're referencing is if they reduce the cellulosic standard and if they reduce the advanced standard by the same amount, what can they do with the overall total? And they, again, it's our belief that they have the discretion to lower that total by the same amount or maintain the statutory level. And in the case where they would maintain the statutory level, that would, in fact, increase the bucket that is, you know, open to any renewable fuel.
Great. And operator, this
by the way, I can. Can I just add a quick comment there? So I do want to add that I certainly have a lot of confidence in the professionalism of the people at EPA. We've seen them work through renewable fuel standard issues in a complex new regulatory environment. I think so far really fact-based and in a very professional and very accurate way. And I think that's in part why we're so surprised about these leaked volumes, which at this point I still hope is just simply not the case. So I just want to add that what I've seen of them so far, what I've seen is of their work so far is stuff that gives me a lot of confidence. So we hope they see the right implementation.
And our final question today comes from Zach Coleman with the Washington Examiner.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sorry if there's a little background noise here. Just wanted to know, the House is working on legislation related to the RFS. Where do you believe advanced biofuels are factoring into that discussion, and what are your supporters saying on the Hill? I personally haven't heard a whole lot from them since this leaked draft, at least regarding the advanced biofuels. So are you going to be leaning on them at all to talk to the administration? If you could walk me through how you get the Hill engaged, that would be helpful.
Well, this is Jeff, and I guess I can start. I think we haven't seen nearly as much discussion or engagement from the Hill, really following, you know, the House Energy Committee's hearings this summer and their white paper process. They've been, you know, preoccupied with other matters in the last couple months and certainly the last several weeks. I think they're, you know, Congress, like everybody else, is kind of waiting to see what EPA does here. But I guess I would also say that there is strong support in the Senate today and within the House for not only conventional biofuels but certainly strong support for continuing to see growth and investment in advanced and cellulosic biofuels. So we're seeing less engagement currently, but that may change. I don't know.
Great. Well, I think we've hit the end of our allotted time here. This is Ann. I want to thank everybody for joining. I hope there was a lot of good information for you today. I want to thank our speakers who did a great job. You will have received an email from the Fuels America team with that additional background on the analysis that Jeff Cooper mentioned. Please feel free to reach out to us if you need any additional information or if you have further questions. And with that, operator, I think we are ready to close the call.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. We appreciate your participation.